Mr. Davy, reel 2.
After your enlistment at Whitehall, what happened to you then?
It was Christmas 1916 when I enlisted at Whitehall, and when I had my interviews at Whitehall. And the next batch was not due to go to Eastleigh until the first days of January 1917, and so I was told to go home and come back then, and I went back then and joined up with a matter of, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 others going to the same place.
Which place was that?
It was to Eastleigh, South Sea.
That was the Royal Marine Barracks?
That was Royal Marine Artillery Barracks.
I see.
At that time, the Royal Marine Artillery was an entirely separate regiment to the Royal Marine Light Infantry.
Mm. What happened to you immediately on arrival at Eastleigh?
Well, that was my first experience of a somewhat caustic outlook on life of the average regular soldier of those days, who looked at me with unbelieving eyes, said, "What do you think you're going to be, a Marine?" sort of thing. But they were very kind, really. I know there was some caustic back chat about what they're taking into the regiment these days.
When you arrived with the other new recruits, how were you all organised on arrival?
We were sent, after we'd been booked in, we were sent to the receiving room, which was I remember what it was. It was number 36 room. It was a long room in Eastleigh Barracks. We were sent there, and there was an old pensioner bombardier in charge of the room who took us straight away to the coffee bar and provided us with supper. And I remember, for one reason and another, I'd been existing all day on snacks, snatched here and there, sausage rolls and roll and cheese and things like that. And I remember the meal very well because I was so hungry at the time. It was sausage and mash. And I was famished.
Now, for the purpose of this training course, first of all, about the barracks arrangements, how were you organised in your back rooms?
Barrack rooms were long dormitory style rooms with accommodation around more or less 30.
Mm. And would these 30 have been all long service recruits?
And these were mixed recruits.
How do you mean mixed?
Long service and short service. And of course the short service men were older. About that time, the age group aspect of short service men was coming into the field, and I suppose they would be at least in the high 20s, if not more, probably in the 30s. But we were all mixed, and after the first day or two in the receiving room, when we did all our preliminary booking and medicals, we were posted to a recruit room. Mine was number 34, I remember. And this again was contained a mixed bag of long service and short service men.
Mm. As regards the long service recruits, the youngsters What kind of people tended to be attracted to the Marines? Is there any way you could sort of classify them?
I think that one of the motives of motivating factors in the long service Marines, which were all youngsters, or the long service recruits, which were all youngsters. One was the fact that it was one of the few places they could get in at that age, and the other was the fact that it was the only regiment left with a little bit of glamour attached to it. They did wear peacetime uniform and all those kind of things.
See, I'm curious for people who joined as long service recruits, and if it was just the age thing, being able to get in, of course they could have joined the Navy as boy seamen. If, on the other hand, they wanted regimental service, they could have waited a bit and joined the Army. And I'm just wondering, you know, why they were attracted to the Marines.
No, really. They were a mixed bag of people. Some very good chaps, quite reasonably well educated, and some rough ones.
For purposes of training, were the long service and the HOs people trained together?
No, they were on the. They were what was called. You see, Isney Barracks was divided into two parts. It was the divisional headquarters of the Portsmouth RMA, and it was also the recruits depot. Well, the recruits depot and the recruits parade consisted of squads which were formed as numbers assembled insufficient quantity to make a squad up. And the recruit squads on parade in my time, probably six or eight squads on parade, three or four of which were long service squads and three or four were short service squads. And you moved up the parade, starting at the back, as your subjects progressed. You know.
Was there any difference in the training period for HOs and long service?
The HOs got a shorter period, and while the intentions of the training were the same, and the division into periods was the same, was curtailed in the case of the short service men, who after they got to a certain point, which I suppose can be described as the point at which they were a complete infantry soldier but nothing else, they were then diverted to Port Cumberland, where they specialised in shore service gunnery, whereas the HO, the long service recruits at this point, which they reached after a longer period of training.
Yeah. Can we concentrate a bit more about what was happening to you rather than talking about the thing in sort of too academic a fashion? Because I'm concerned with your experiences, not, you know, a sort of history of the Marine Corps.
Well,
as far as you were concerned and your training and your experiences, tell me a bit about how the training program was organized.
Well, my squad instructor was a sergeant named Tim Daly, D-A-L-E-Y, his name, and he took the squad over from the moment it was completed, and he became the father and mother of the squad until you were passed out as the complete Marine artilleryman. And he later became Sir Dennis Daly, Lord Mayor of Portsmouth in World War II.
Yeah.
But of course, in my time, he was just Sergeant Tim Daly.
Yes, how was your training organised? How did it start and develop?
Well, it was divided into periods, which, as far as I can recollect, were 2 or 3 weeks each. The first period would be squad drill without arms. Then there would be squad drill with arms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any particular memories of that part of the
training? Extended order work.
Was all of the drill, did it seem to be appropriate for modern warfare conditions?
Well, of course, I suppose such basic things as squad drill, if they're necessary at all, they don't change. They're just there. It's really intended to teach you to look like a soldier and behave like a soldier and do what you're told.
Yeah, you were telling me last time about this Marine still being concerned in their squad drill with the possibility of having to receive cavalry.
Oh, yes, well,
tell me that as a little story. What happened
further,
exactly?
When you became further advanced in your training, you did, one of the periods was extended order work. Well, now, extended order work, I don't know if they teach it now, but I've never seen any for years in use. But it was a thing that was designed for open ground as opposed to trench warfare. And of course, the trench warfare of the First World War inhibited anything like that from ever taking place. But it was still taught, and presumably it was considered that in any ordinary type of warfare it would still be required. And of course, it would still be required in in the more open warfare, which was the Marine speciality,
yeah,
like small raids and things like that. But
the open order drill, fine, and yeah, that would standard throughout the Army as well as the Marines.
Yeah.
But this forming squares for cavalry,
oh, yes,
so that's really what I'm getting at. Tell me what
there
happened on that occasion.
Thing that was taught there, which also was still extant at that period. At that time, there were no tanks, there were still cavalry. And therefore, cavalry had to be dealt with. And though there was nothing like that going on at the time because of trench warfare, but normally you would expect that attacks of cavalry could take place upon infantry.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore one of the drills taught, which were merely to get the idea into your head of how to do it, was in the matter of infantry receiving an attack by cavalry.
Well, what happened?
And the order was prepare to receive cavalry, in which case, from the formation in which you were marching, you immediately melted into a hedge of bayonets with the front rank kneeling and the front rank with the bayonets over the shoulders of the kneeling men.
Mm-hmm.
And I should imagine it would be almost impossible to break through a rank like that.
Mm.
And then there were requirements of that called cavalry right and cavalry left.
What did they mean?
They just meant you change formation to receive an attack by cavalry from the right or left.
Mm-hmm.
And I should imagine, really, they were based on the experiences in the squares.
Another part of your training course was musketry. What were the standards of musketry that you were expected to achieve?
Oh, yes. Well, musketry was one of our courses, and you fired at various points from 1,000 yards down to 200 yards, and at moving targets and at targets in butts and so on. And if you did well enough, you became a marksman and you got prize money for that. Mm. But you were expected to hit it.
Was there any particular rapid rate fire you had to achieve?
I remember we did one firing that we did was 5 rounds rapid, and another was 10 rounds rapid. The rifles that we fired, of course, were short magazine Lee Enfields.
Mm.
In fact, we did much of our recruits course. There was a shortage of rifles, apparently, throughout the country at this time, because as much of our recruit course as could be done without detriment was done with old Canadian rifles like Ross's.
Mm-hmm.
And long Lee Enfields, and so on. But we were given the short Lee Enfields when we actually did firing and eventually acquired our own rifles when we passed off parade.
Mm.